Side 2. The Gods Themselves. Continuing on page 51. What kind of trouble? Asked Bronowski. Suppose the Earth turned into a whiff of gas in a period of about 5 minutes. Would you consider that trouble? Because of the pumping? Because of the pumping. And how about the world of the paramen? Would they be in danger too? I'm sure of it. A different danger, but danger. Bronowski stood up and began pacing. He wore his brown hair thick and long in what had once been called a Buster Brown. Now he was clutching at it. He said, if the paramen are more intelligent than we are, would they be running the pump? Surely they would know it was dangerous before we did. I've thought of that, said Lamont. What I guess is that they've started pumping for the first time, and they, like us, got the process started for the apparent good it would bring, and worried about consequences later. But you say you know the consequences now. Would they be slower than you were? It depends on if and when they look for those consequences. The pump is too attractive to try to spoil. I wouldn't have looked myself if I hadn't... But what's on your mind, Mike? Bronowski stopped his pacing, looked full at Lamont, and said, I think we've got something. Lamont looked at him wildly, then leaped forward to seize the other's sleeve. With the parasymbols? Tell me, Mike. It was while you were with Hallam, while you were actually with Hallam. I haven't known exactly what to do about it, because I wasn't sure what was going on. And now? I'm still not sure. One of their foils came through with 4 symbols. Oh? In the Latin alphabet. And it can be pronounced. What? Here it is. Bronowski produced the foil with the air of a conjurer. Incised on it, quite different from the delicate and intricate spirals and differential glistenings of the parasymbols, were 4 broad childlike letters. F-E-E-R. What do you suppose that means? Asked Lamont blandly. So far, all I've been able to think of is that it's F-E-A-R misspelled. Is that why you were cross-examining me? You thought someone on the other side was experiencing fear? I thought it might have some connection with your own obviously increasing excitement over the last month. Frankly, Pete, I didn't like being kept in the dark. Okay, now, let's not jump to conclusions. You're the one with experience with fragmentary messages. Wouldn't you say that the paramen were beginning to experience fear concerning the electron pump? Not necessarily at all, said Bronowski. I don't know how much they can sense of this universe. If they can sense the tungsten we lay out for them, if they can sense our presence, perhaps they are sensing our state of mind. Perhaps they are trying to reassure us, telling us there is no reason to fear. Then why don't they say N-O-F-E-E-R? Because they don't know our language that well yet. Then I can't take it to Bert. I wouldn't. It's ambiguous. In fact, I wouldn't go to Bert till we get something more from the other side. Who knows what they're trying to say? No, I can't wait, Mike. I know I'm right, and we have no time. All right. But if you see Bert, you'll be burning your bridges. Your colleagues will never forgive you. Have you thought of talking to the physicists here? You can't put pressure on Hallam on your own. But a whole group of you... Lamont shook his head vigorously. Not at all. The men at this station survive by virtue of their jellyfish quality. There isn't one who would stand against him. Trying to rally the others to put pressure on Hallam would be like asking strands of cooked spaghetti to come to attention. Bronowski's soft face looked unwontedly grim. You may be right. I know I'm right, said Lamont. Just as grimly. 7. It had taken time to pin the senator down, time that Lamont had resented losing, the more so since nothing further in Latin letters had come from the paramen. No message of any kind, though Bronowski had sent across 6, each with a carefully selected combination of para-symbols and each incorporating both F-E-E-R and F-E-A-R. Lamont wasn't sure of the significance of the half-dozen variations, but Bronowski seemed hopeful. Yet nothing had happened, and now Lamont was at last in to see Bert. The senator was thin-faced, sharp-eyed, and elderly. He had been the head of the Committee on Technology and the Environment for a generation. He took his job seriously, and had proved that a dozen times. He fiddled now with the old-fashioned necktie that he affected, and that had become his trademark, and said, "I can only give you half an hour, son." He looked at his wristwatch. Lamont was not worried. He expected to interest Senator Burt enough to make him forget about time limits. Nor did he attempt to begin at the beginning. His intentions here were quite different from those in connection with Hallam. He said, "I won't bother with the mathematics, Senator, but I will assume you realize that through pumping, the natural laws of the two universes are being mixed." "Stirred together," said the Senator calmly, "with equilibrium coming in about 10 to the 30th years. Is that the figure?" His eyebrows in repose arched up and then down, giving his lined face a permanent air of surprise. "It is," said Lamont, "but it is arrived at by assuming that the alien laws seeping into our universe and theirs spread outward from the point of entry at the speed of light. That is just an assumption, and I believe it to be wrong." "Why?" "The only measured rate of mixing is within the plutonium-186 sent into this universe. That rate of mixing is extremely slow at first, presumably because matter is dense and increases with time. If the plutonium is mixed with less dense matter, the rate of mixing increases more rapidly. From a few measurements of this sort, it has been calculated that the permeation rate would increase to the speed of light in a vacuum. It would take some time for the alien laws to work their way into the atmosphere, far less time to work their way to the top of the atmosphere, and then off through space in every direction at 300,000 kilometers per second, thinning into harmlessness in no time." Lamont paused a moment to consider how best to go on, and the senator picked it up at once. "However," he urged, with the manner of a man not willing to waste time, "it's a convenient assumption that seems to make sense and seems to make no trouble. But what if it is not matter that offers resistance to the permeation of the alien laws, but the basic fabric of the universe itself?" "What is the basic fabric?" "I can't put it in words. There's a mathematical expression which I think represents it, but I can't put it into words. The basic fabric of the universe is that which dictates the laws of nature. It is the basic fabric of our universe that makes it necessary for energy to be conserved. It is the basic fabric of the para-universe, with a weave, so to speak, somewhat different from ours, that makes their nuclear interaction 100 times stronger than ours. And so, if it is the basic fabric that is being penetrated, sir, then the presence of matter, dense or not, can have only a secondary influence. The rate of penetration is greater in a vacuum than in dense mass, but not very much greater. The rate of penetration in outer space may be great in earthly terms, but it is only a small fraction of the speed of light." "Which means?" "That the alien fabric is not dissipating as quickly as we think, but is piling up, so to speak, within the solar system to a much greater concentration than we have been assuming." "I see," said the senator, nodding his head. "And how long, then, will it be before the space within the solar system is brought to equilibrium?" "Less than 10 to the 30th years, I imagine." "Far less, sir. Less than 10 to the 10th years, I think. Perhaps 50 billion years, give or take a couple of billion." "Not much in comparison, but enough, huh? No immediate cause for alarm, huh?" "But I'm afraid that is immediate cause for alarm, sir. Damage will be done long before equilibrium is reached. Because of the pumping, the strong nuclear interaction is growing steadily stronger in our universe at every moment." "Enough stronger to measure?" "Perhaps not, sir." "Not even after 20 years of pumping?" "Perhaps not, sir." "Then why worry?" "Because, sir, Upon the strength of the strong nuclear interaction rests the rate at which hydrogen fuses to helium in the core of the sun. If the interaction strengthens even unnoticeably, the rate of hydrogen fusion in the sun will increase markedly. The sun maintains the balance between radiation and gravitation with great delicacy, and to upset that balance in favor of radiation, as we are now doing,
yes,
will cause an enormous explosion. Under our laws of nature, it is impossible for a star as small as the sun to become a supernova. Under the altered laws, it may not be. I doubt that we would have warning. The sun would build up to a vast explosion, and in 8 minutes after that, you and I will be dead, and the earth will quickly vaporize into an expanding puff of vapor. And nothing can be done? If it is too late to avoid upsetting the equilibrium, nothing. If it is not yet too late, then we must stop pumping. The senator cleared his throat. Before I agreed to see you, young man, I inquired as to your background, since you were not personally known to me. Among those I queried was Dr. Hallam. You know him, I suppose.
Yes, sir.
A corner of Lamont's mouth twitched, but his voice held even. I know him well. He tells me, said the senator, glancing at a paper on his desk, that you are a troublemaking idiot of doubtful sanity, and he demands that I refuse to see you. Lamont said in a voice he strove to keep calm, Are those his words, sir?
His exact words.
Then why have you agreed to see me, sir? Ordinarily, if I received something like this from Hallam, I wouldn't have seen you. My time is valuable, and heaven knows I see more troublemaking idiots of doubtful sanity than bears thinking of, even among those who come to me with the highest recommendations. In this one case, though, I didn't like Hallam's demand. You don't make demands of the senator, and Hallam had better learn that.
Then you will help me, sir?
Help you do what?
Why, arrange to have the pumping halted.
That? Not at all. Quite impossible.
Why not? Demanded Lamont. You are the head of the Committee on Technology and the Environment, and it is precisely your task to stop the pumping or any technological procedure that threatens irreversible harm to the environment. There can be no greater, no more irreversible harm than threatened by pumping.
Certainly. Certainly, if you are right. But it seems that what your story amounts to is that your assumptions are different from the accepted ones. Who is to say which set of assumptions is right?
Sir, the structure I have built explains several things that are left doubtful in the accepted view.
Well, then, your colleagues ought to accept your modification, and in that case, you would scarcely have come to me, I imagine.
Sir, my colleagues will not believe. Their self-interest stands in the way.
As your self-interest stands in the way of your believing you might be wrong.
Young man, my powers on paper are enormous, but I can only succeed when the public is willing to let me. Let me give you a lesson in practical politics. He looked at his wristwatch, leaned back, and smiled. His offer was not characteristic of him, but an editorial in the Terrestrial Post that morning had referred to him as a consummate politician, the most skilled in the International Congress, and the glow that that had roused within him still lingered. It is a mistake, he said, to suppose that the public wants the environment protected or their lives saved, and that they will be grateful to any idealist who will fight for such ends. What the public wants is their own individual comfort. We know that well enough from our experience in the environmental crisis of the 20th century. Once it was well known that cigarettes increased the incidence of lung cancer, the obvious remedy was to stop smoking. But the desired remedy was a cigarette that did not encourage cancer. When it became clear that the internal combustion engine was polluting the atmosphere dangerously, the obvious remedy was to abandon such engines, and the desired remedy was to develop non-polluting engines. Now then, young man, don't ask me to stop the pumping. The economy and comfort of the entire planet depend on it. Tell me instead how to keep the pumping from exploding the sun.
Lamont said, There is no way, Senator. We are dealing with something here that is so basic we can't play with it. We must stop it.
Ah, and you can suggest only that we go back to matters as they were before pumping.
We must.
In that case, you will need hard and fast proof that you are right.
The best proof, said Lamont stiffly, is to have the sun explode.
I suppose you don't want me to go that far.
Not necessary, perhaps. Why can't you get Hallam to back you up?
Because he is a small man who finds himself the father of the electron pump. How can he admit his child will destroy the Earth?
I see what you mean, but he is still the father of the electron pump to the whole world, and only his word would carry sufficient weight in this respect.
Lamont shook his head. He would never give in. He would rather see the sun explode.
The senator said, Then force his hand. You have a theory, but a theory by itself is meaningless. Surely there must be some way of checking it. The rate of radioactive breakdown of, say, uranium, depends on the interactions within the nucleus. Has that rate been changing in a fashion predicted by your theory, but not the standard one?
Again, Lamont shook his head. Ordinary radioactivity depends on the weak nuclear interaction, and, unfortunately, experiments of that sort will yield only borderline evidence. By the time it showed sufficiently to be unmistakable, it would be too late.
What else, then?
There are pion interactions of a specific sort that might yield unmistakable data now. Better still, there are quark-quark combinations that have produced puzzling results recently that I am sure I can explain.
Well, there you are.
Yes, but in order to obtain that data, I must make use of the large proton synchrotron on the moon, sir, and no time on that will be available for years, I've checked, unless someone pulls the strings.
Meaning me?
Meaning you, Senator.
Not as long as Dr. Hallam says this about you, son.
And Senator Burt's gnarled finger tapped the piece of paper in front of him.
I can't get out on that limb.
But the existence of the world.
Prove it.
Override Hallam and I'll prove it.
Prove it and I'll override Hallam.
Lamont drew a deep breath. Senator, supposing there's just a trifling chance I'm right. Isn't even that trifling chance worth fighting for? It means everything, all mankind, the entire planet.
You want me to fight the good fight?
I'd like to. There's a certain drama in going down in a good cause.
Any decent politician is masochistic enough to dream now and then of going down in flames while the angels sing.
But, Dr. Lamont, to do that, one has to have a fighting chance. One has to have something to fight for that may, just may, win out. If I back you, I'll accomplish nothing with your word alone against the infinite desirability of pumping. Shall I demand every man give up the personal comfort and affluence he has learned to get used to, thanks to the pump, just because one man cries doom, while all the other scientists stand against him, and the revered Hallam calls him an idiot? No, sir, I will not go down in flames for nothing.
Lamont said, Then just help me find my proof. You needn't appear in the open if you fear.
I'm not afraid, said Burt abruptly. I'm being practical. Dr. Lamont, your half hour is rather more than gone.
Lamont stared for a moment in frustration, but Burt's expression was a clearly intransigent one now.
Lamont left. Senator Burt did not see his next visitor immediately. Minutes passed while he stared uneasily at the closed door and fiddled with his tie. Could the man have been right? Could he have had the smallest chance of being right?
He had to admit it would be a pleasure to trip Hallam and push his face into the mud and sit on him till he choked.
But it would not happen. Hallam was untouchable. He had had only one set to with Hallam nearly 10 years ago. He had been right dead right, and Hallam had been egregiously wrong, and events had since proved it to be so. And yet, at the time, Bert had been humiliated, and he had almost lost re-election as a result. Bert shook his head in admonition to himself. He might risk re-election in a good cause, but he could not risk humiliation again. He signaled for the next visitor, and his face was calm and bland as he rose to greet him. 8. If by this time Lamont had still felt he had something to lose professionally, he might have hesitated. Joshua Chen was universally unpopular, and anyone who dealt with him was in bad odor at once with almost every corner of the establishment. Chen was a one-man revolutionary whose single voice could somehow always be heard because he brought to his causes an intensity that was utterly overpowering, and because he had built an organization that was more tightly knit than any ordinary political team in the world, as more than one politician was ready to swear. He had been one of the important factors accounting for the speed with which the pump had taken over the planet's energy needs. The pump's virtues were clear and obvious, as clear as non-pollution and as obvious as for free. Yet there might have been a longer rearguard fight by those who wanted nuclear energy, not because it was better, but because it had been the friend of their childhood. Yet when Chen beat his drums, the world listened just a little harder. Now he sat there, his broad cheekbones and round face bearing evidence of the approximately three-quarter admixture of Chinese ancestry. He said, "Let me get this straight. You're speaking only for yourself?" "Yes," said Lamont tightly. "Hallam doesn't back me. In fact, Hallam says I'm mad. Do you have to have Hallam's approval before you can move?" "I need no one's approval," said Chen with predictable arrogance. Then he lapsed back into thoughtful consideration. "You say the paramen are farther advanced in technology than we are?" Lamont had gone that far in the direction of compromise. He had avoided saying they were more intelligent. Farther advanced in technology was less offensive, but just as true. "That is clear," said Lamont, "if only because they can send material across the gap between the universes and we can't." "Then why did they start the pump if it is dangerous? Why are they continuing it?" Lamont was learning to compromise in more than one direction. He might have said that Chen was not the first to ask this, but it would have sounded condescending, perhaps impatient, and he chose not to do so. Lamont said, "They were anxious to get started with something that was so apparently desirable as a source of energy, just as we were. I have reason to think they're as disturbed about it now as I am." "That's still your word. You have no definite evidence about their state of mind." "None that I can present at this moment." "Then it's not enough." "Can we afford to risk—" "It's not enough, Professor. There's no evidence. I haven't built my reputation by shooting down targets at random. My missiles have sped true to the mark every time because I knew what I was doing. But when I get the evidence, then I'll back you. If the evidence satisfies me, I assure you neither Hallam nor the Congress will be able to resist the tide. So get the evidence and come see me again." "But by then it will be too late." Chen shrugged. "Perhaps. Much more likely you will find that you were wrong and no evidence is to be had." "I'm not wrong." Lamont took a deep breath and said in a confidential tone, "Mr. Chen, there are very likely trillions upon trillions of inhabited planets in the universe, and among them there may be billions with intelligent life and highly developed technologies. The same is probably true of the para-universe. It must be that in the history of the two universes, there have been many pairs of worlds that came into contact and began pumping. There may be dozens or even hundreds of pumps scattered across junction points of the two universes." "Pure speculation. But if so, then it may be that in dozens or hundreds of cases, the mixture of natural law advanced locally to an extent sufficient to explode a planet's sun. The effect might have spread outward, The energy of a supernova, added to the changing natural law, may have set off explosions among neighboring stars, which in turn set off others. In time, perhaps an entire core of a galaxy or of a galactic arm will explode. But that is only imagination, of course. Is it? There are hundreds of quasars in the universe, tiny bodies the size of several solar systems, but shining with the light of 100 full-size ordinary galaxies. You are telling me that the quasars are what are left of pumping planets? I'm suggesting that, in the century and a half since they were discovered, astronomers have still failed to account for their sources of energy. Nothing in this universe will account for it. Nothing. Doesn't it follow, then? What about the para-universe? Is it full of quasars, too? I wouldn't think so. Conditions are different there. Para-theory makes it seem quite definite that fusion takes place much more easily over there, so the stars must be considerably smaller than ours on the average. It would take a much smaller supply of easily fusing hydrogen to produce the energy our sun does. A supply as large as that of our sun would explode spontaneously. If our laws permeate the para-universe, hydrogen becomes a little more difficult to fuse. The para-stars begin to cool down. Well, that's not so bad, said Chen. They can use pumping to supply themselves with the necessary energy. By your speculations, they're in fine shape. Not really, said Lamont. Until now, he hadn't thought the para situation through. Once our end explodes, the pumping stops. They can't keep it up without us, and that means they'll face a cooling star without pump energy. They might be worse off than we. We'd go out in a painless flash while their agony would be long drawn out. You have a good imagination, Professor, said Chen, but I'm not buying it. I don't see any chance of giving up pumping on nothing more than your imagination. Do you know what the pump means to mankind? It's not just the free, clean, and copious energy. Look beyond that. What it means is that mankind no longer has to work for a living. It means that for the first time in history, mankind can turn its collective brains to the more important problem of developing its true potential. For instance, not all the medical advances of 2.5 centuries have succeeded in advancing man's full lifespan much past 100 years. We've been told by gerontologists over and over that there is nothing, in theory, to stand in the way of human immortality. But so far, not enough attention has been concentrated on this. Lamont said angrily, Immortality! You're talking of pipe dreams! Perhaps you're a judge of pipe dreams, Professor, said Chen. But I intend to see that research into immortality begins. It won't begin if pumping ends. Then we are back to expensive energy, scarce energy, dirty energy. Earth's 2 billions will have to go back to work for a living, and the pipe dream of immortality will remain a pipe dream. It will anyway. No one is going to be immortal. No one is even going to live out a normal lifetime. Ah, but that is your theory only. Lamont weighed the possibilities and decided to gamble. Mr. Chen, a while ago I said I was not willing to explain my knowledge of the state of mind of the paramen. Well, let me try. We have been receiving messages. Yes, but can you interpret them? We received an English word. Chen frowned slightly. He suddenly put his hands in his pockets, stretched his short legs before him, and leaned back in his chair. And what was the English word? Fear. Lamont did not feel it necessary to mention the misspelling. Fear, repeated Chen. And what do you think it means? Isn't it clear that they're afraid of the pumping phenomenon? Not at all. If they were afraid, they would stop it. I think they're afraid all right, but they're afraid that our side will stop it. You've gotten across your intention to them, and if we stop it, as you want us to do, they've got to stop also. You said yourself they can't continue without us. It's a two-ended proposition. I don't blame them for being afraid. Lamont sat silent. I see, said Chen, "that you haven't thought of that. Well, then, we'll push for immortality. I think that will be the more popular cause."
"Oh, popular causes," said Lamont slowly. "I didn't understand what you found important. How old are you, Mr. Chen?"
For a moment, Chen blinked rapidly, then he turned away. He left the room, walking rapidly, with his hands clenched.
Lamont looked up his biography later. Chen was 60, and his father had died at 62. But it didn't matter.
9. "You don't look as though you had any luck at all," said Bronowski.
Lamont was sitting in his laboratory, staring at the toes of his shoes and noting idly that they seemed unusually scuffed.
He shook his head.
"No."
"Even the great Chen failed you?"
"He would do nothing. He wants evidence, too. They all want evidence, but anything you offer them is rejected. What they really want is their damned pump, or their reputation, or their place in history. Chen wants immortality."
"What do you want, Pete?" asked Bronowski softly.
"Mankind's safety," said Lamont. He looked at the other's quizzical eyes. "You don't believe me?"
"Oh, I believe you. But what do you really want?"
"Well then, by God," and Lamont brought his hand down flat on the desk before him in a loud slap, "I want to be right, and that I have, for I am right."
"You're sure?"
"I'm sure. And there's nothing I'm worried about, because I intend to win. You know, when I left Chen, I came near to despising myself."
"You?"
"Yes, I. Why not? I kept thinking, at every turn, Hallam stops me. As long as Hallam refutes me, everyone has an excuse not to believe me. While Hallam stands like a rock against me, I must fail. Why, then, didn't I work through him? Why didn't I butter him up, indeed? Why didn't I maneuver him into supporting me, instead of needling him into fighting me?"
"Do you think you could have?"
"No, never. But in my despair, I thought, well, all sorts of things. That I might go to the moon, perhaps. Of course, when I first turned him against me, there was as yet no question of Earth's doom. But I took care to make it worse when that question arose. But, as you imply, nothing could have turned him against the pump."
"But you don't seem to despise yourself now."
"No, because my conversation with Chen brought a dividend. It showed me I was wasting time."
"So it would seem."
"Yes, but needlessly. It is not here on Earth that the solution lies. I told Chen that our sun might blow up, but that the parasun would not. Yet that would not save the paramen, for when our sun blew up and our end of the pump halted, so would theirs. They cannot continue without us, do you see?"
"Yes, of course I see."
"Then why don't we think of the reverse? We can't continue without them. In which case, who cares whether we stop the pump or not? Let's get the paramen to stop."
"Ah, but will they?"
"They said F-E-E-R, and it means they're afraid. Chen said they feared us. They feared we would stop the pump. But I don't believe that for a moment. They're afraid." I sat silent when Chen made his suggestion. He thought he had me. He was quite wrong. I was only thinking at that moment that we had to get the paramen to stop. And we've got to. Mike, I abandon everything except you. You're the hope of the world. Get through to them somehow. Bronowski laughed, and there was almost a childlike glee in it. "Pete," he said, "you're a genius."
"Aha, you've noticed.
No, I mean it. You guess what I want to say before I can say it. I've been sending message after message, using their symbols in a way that I guessed might signify the pump, and using our word as well. And I did my best to gather what information I've scrabbled together over many months to use their symbols in a way signifying disapproval, and using an English word again. I had no idea whether I was getting through or was a mile off base, and from the fact that I never got an answer, I had little hope."
"You didn't tell me that's what you were trying to do."
"Well, this part of the problem is my baby.
You take your sweet time explaining paratheory to me. So what happened?
So yesterday, I sent off exactly two words, our language. I scrawled P-U-M-P-B-A-D.
And this morning I picked up a return message at last, and it was simple enough and straightforward, too. It went Y-E-S-P-U-M-P-B-A-D-B-A-D-B-A-D.
Here, look at it.
Lamont's hand trembled as it held the foil.
There's no mistaking that, is there? That's confirmation, isn't it?
It seems so to me. Who will you take this to?
To no one, said Lamont decisively. I argue no more. They will tell me I faked the message, and there's no point in sitting still for that. Let the paramen stop the pump, and it will stop on our side, too, and nothing we can do unilaterally will start it up again. The entire station will then be on fire to prove that I was right, and the pump is dangerous.
How do you figure that?
Because that would be the only way they could keep themselves from being torn apart by a mob demanding the pump and infuriated at not getting it. Don't you think so?
Well, maybe. But one thing bothers me.
What's that?
If the paramen are so convinced that the pump is dangerous, why haven't they stopped it already? I took occasion to check a while ago, and the pump is working swimmingly.
Lamont frowned. Perhaps they don't want a unilateral stoppage. They consider us their partners, and they want a mutual agreement to stop. Don't you suppose that might be so?
It might.
But it might also be that communication is less than perfect, that they don't yet quite understand the significance of the word B-A-D. From what I said to them via their symbols, which I might well have twisted utterly, they may think that B-A-D means what we consider G-O-O-D.
Oh, no.
Well, that's your hope, but there's no payoff on hopes. Mike, just keep on sending messages. Use as many of the words they use as possible, and keep ringing the changes. You're the expert, and it's in your hands. Eventually, they'll know enough words to say something clear and unmistakable, and then we'll explain that we're willing to have the pump stopped.
We lack the authority to make any such statement.
Yes, but they won't know, and in the end we'll be mankind's heroes.
Even if they execute us first?
Even so. It's in your hands, Mike, and I'm sure it won't take much longer.
10.
And yet it did. 2 weeks passed without another message, and the strain grew worse. Gronowski showed it. The momentary lightness of heart had dissipated, and he entered Lamont's laboratory in glum silence. They stared at each other, and finally Gronowski said, "It's all over the place that you've received your show cause." Lamont had clearly not shaved that morning. His laboratory had a forlorn look about it, a not-quite-definable packing-up look. He shrugged.
"So what? It doesn't bother me. What does bother me is that Physical Reviews rejected my paper."
"You said you were expecting that."
"Yes, but I thought they might give me reasons. They might point out what they thought were fallacies, errors, unwarranted assumptions, something I could argue about."
"And they didn't?"
"Not a word. Their referees did not consider the paper suitable for publication. Quote, unquote. They just won't touch it. It's really disheartening, the universal stupidity. I think that I wouldn't grieve at mankind's suicide through sheer evilness of heart or through mere recklessness. There's something so damned undignified at going to destruction through sheer thick-headed stupidity. What's the use of being men if that's how you have to die?"
"Stupidity," muttered Gronowski.
"What else do you call it? And they want me to show cause why I ought not to be fired for the great crime of being right."
"Everyone seems to know that you consulted Chen."
"Yes."
Lamont put his fingers to the bridge of his nose and wearily rubbed his eyes. "I apparently got him annoyed enough to go to Hallam with tales, and now the accusation is that I've been trying to sabotage the pump project
by unwarranted and unsupported fright tactics in an unprofessional manner, and that this makes me unsuitable for employment on the station. They can prove that easily, Pete. I suppose they can. It doesn't matter. What are you going to do? Nothing, said Lamont indignantly. Let them do their worst. I'll rely on red tape. Every step of this thing will take weeks, months. And meanwhile, you keep working. We'll hear from the paramen yet. Bernowski looked miserable. Pete, suppose we don't. Maybe it's time you think about this again. Lamont looked up sharply. What are you talking about? Tell them you're wrong. Do penance. Beat your breast. Give up. Never! By God, Mike, we're playing a game in which the stakes are all the world and every living creature on it. Yes, but what's that to you? You're not married. You have no children. I know your father is dead. You never mention your mother or any siblings. I doubt if there is any human being on earth to whom you are emotionally attached as an individual. So go your way and the hell with it all. And you? I'll do the same. I'm divorced and I have no children. I have a young lady with whom I'm close, and that relationship will continue while it can. Live, enjoy. And tomorrow will take care of itself. Death, when it comes, will be quick. I can't live with that philosophy. Mike? Mike, what is all this? Are you trying to tell me that we're not going to get through? Are you giving up on the paramen? Bernowski looked away. He said, Pete, I did get an answer. Last night. I thought I'd wait for today and think about it. But why think? Here it is. Lamont's eyes were staring questions. He took the foil and looked at it. There was no punctuation. Pump, not, stop, not, stop, we, not, stop, pump, we, not, here, danger, not, here, not, here, you, stop, please, stop, you, stop, so, we, stop, please, you, stop, danger, 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 stop, stop, you, stop, pump. By God, muttered Bernowski, they sound desperate. Lamont was still staring. He said nothing. Bernowski said, I gather that somewhere on the other side is someone like you, a para-Lamont. And he can't get his para-Hallams to stop either. And while we're begging them to save us, he's begging us to save them. Lamont said, But if we show this, they'll say you're lying, that it's a hoax you've concocted to save your psychotically conceived nightmare. They can say that of me, maybe, but they can't say it of you. You'll back me, Mike. You'll testify that you received this and how. Bernowski reddened. What good would that do? They'll say that somewhere in the para-universe there is a nut like yourself and that two crackpots got together. They'll say that the message proves that the constituted authorities in the para-universe are convinced there's no danger. Mike, fight this through with me. There's no use, Pete. You said yourself, stupidity. Those paramen may be more advanced than ourselves, even more intelligent, as you insist. But it's plain to see that they're just as stupid as we are, and that ends it. Schiller pointed that out, and I believe him. Who? Schiller, a German dramatist of 3 centuries ago. In a play about Joan of Arc, he said, Against stupidity, the gods themselves contend in vain. I'm no god, and I'll contend no longer. Let it go, Pete, and go your way. Maybe the world will last our time, and if not, there's nothing that can be done anyway. I'm sorry, Pete. You fought the good fight, but you lost, and I'm through. He was gone, and Lamont was alone. He sat in his chair, fingers aimlessly drumming. Somewhere in the sun, protons were clinging together with just a trifling additional avidity, and with each moment that avidity grew and at some moment the delicate balance would break down.
"And no one on earth will live to know I was right," cried out Lamont,
and blinked to keep back the tears. Part 2. The Gods Themselves. 1A. Dua did not have much trouble leading the others. She always expected trouble, but somehow it never came. Never real trouble. But then why should it? Odin objected in his lofty way. "Stay put," he would say. "You know you annoy Trit." He never spoke of his own annoyance. Rationals didn't grow annoyed over trifles. Still, he hovered over Trit almost as persistently as Trit hovered over the children. But then Odin always let her have her way if she were persistent enough, and would even intercede with Trit. Sometimes he even admitted he was proud of her ability, of her independence. He wasn't a bad leftling, she thought, with absent-minded affection. Trit was harder to handle, and he had a sour way of looking at her when she was, well, when she was as she wished to be. But then rightlings were like that. He was a rightling to her, but a parental to the children, and the latter took precedence always. Which was good, because she could always count on one child or the other taking him away, just as things grew uncomfortable. Still, Dua didn't mind Trit very much. Except for melting, she tended to ignore him. Odin was another thing. He had been exciting at first. Just his presence had made her outlines shimmer and fade. And the fact that he was irrational made him all the more exciting somehow. She didn't understand her reaction to that. It was part of her queerness. She had grown used to her queerness. Almost. Dua sighed. When she was a child, when she still thought of herself as an individual, a single being, and not as part of a triad, she was much more aware of that queerness. She was much more made aware of it by the others. As little a thing as the surface at evening. She had loved the surface at evening. The other emotionals had called it cold and gloomy, and had quivered and coalesced when she described it for them. They were ready enough to emerge in the warmth of midday and stretch and feed, but that was exactly what made the midday dull. She didn't like to be around the twittering lot of them. She had to eat, of course, but she liked it much better in the evening when there was very little food, but everything was dim, deep red, and she was alone. Of course, she described it as colder and more wistful than it was when she talked to the others, in order to watch them grow hard-edged as they imagined the chill, or as hard-edged as young emotionals could. After a while, they would whisper about her, and laugh at her, and leave her alone. The small sun was at the horizon now, with the secret ruddiness that she alone was there to see. She spread herself out laterally and thickened dorso-ventrally, absorbing the traces of thin warmth. She munched at it idly, savoring the slightly sour, substanceless taste of the long wavelengths. She had never met another emotional who would admit to liking it, but she could never explain that she associated it with freedom, freedom from the others when she could be alone. Even now the loneliness, the chill, and the deep, deep red brought back those old days before the triad, and even more, quite sharply, her own parental, who would come lumbering after her, forever fearful that she would hurt herself. He had been carefully devoted to her, as parentals always were, to their little mids more than to the other two, as always. It had annoyed her, and she would dream of the day when he would leave her. Parentals always did, eventually. And how she had missed him when one day he finally did. He had come to tell her, just as carefully as he could, despite the difficulty parentals had in putting their feelings into words. She had run from him that day, not in malice, not because she suspected what he had to tell her, but only out of joy. She had managed to find a special place at midday, and had gorged herself in unexpected isolation, and had been filled with a queer, itching sensation that demanded motion and activity. She had slithered over the rocks and had let her edges overlap theirs. It was something she knew to be a grossly improper action for anyone but a baby, and yet it was something at once exciting and soothing. And her parental caught her at last, and had stood before her, silent for a long time, making his eyes small and dense, as though to stop every bit of light reflected from her, to see as much as he could of her, and for as long as possible. At first, she just stared back with the confused thought that he had seen her rub through the rocks and was ashamed of her. But she caught no shame aura, and finally she said, very subdued, "What is it, Daddy?"
"Why, Dua, it's the time. I've been expecting it. Surely you have."
"What time?" Now that it was here, Dua stubbornly would not let herself know. If she refused to know, there would be nothing to know. She never quite got out of that habit. Odin said all emotionals were like that, in the lofty voice he used sometimes, when he was particularly overcome with the importance of being irrational. Her parental had said, "I must pass on. I will not be with you any more." Then he just stood and looked at her, and she couldn't say anything. He said, "You will tell the others."
"Why?"
Dua turned away rebelliously, her outlines vague and growing vaguer, trying to dissipate. She wanted to dissipate altogether, and of course she couldn't. After a while, it hurt and cramped, and she hardened again. Her parental didn't even bother to scold her and tell her that it would be shameful if anyone saw her stretched out so. She said, "They won't care," and immediately felt sorrowful that her parental would be hurt at that. He still called them Little Left and Little Right, but Little Left was all involved with his studies, and Little Right kept talking about forming a triad. Dua was the only one of the three who still felt, well, she was the youngest. Emotionals always were, and with them it was different. Her parental only said, "You will tell them anyway," and they stood looking at each other. She didn't want to tell them. They weren't close anymore. It had been different when they were all little. They could hardly tell themselves apart in those days, left brother from right brother from mid-sister. They were all wispy and would tangle with each other and roll through each other and hide in the walls. No one ever minded that when they were little, none of the grown-ups. But then the brothers grew thick and sober and grew away. And when she complained to her parental, he would only say gently, "You're too old to thin, Dua." She tried not to listen, but left brother kept drawing away and would say, "Don't snuggle, I have no time for you." And right brother began to stay quite hard all the time and became glum and silent. She didn't understand it quite then, and Daddy had not been able to make it clear. He would say every once in a while, as though it were a lesson he had once learned, "Lefts are rationals, Dua. Rights are parentals. They grow up their own way." She didn't like their way. They were no longer children, and she still was, so she flocked with the other emotionals. They all had the same complaints about their brothers. They all talked of coming triads. They all spread in the sun and fed. They all grew more and more the same, and every day the same things were said. And she grew to detest them, and went off by herself whenever she could, so that they left and called her Left-em. It had been a long time now since she had heard that call, but she never thought of that phrase without remembering perfectly the thin, ragged voices that kept it up after her with a kind of half-wit persistence, because they knew it hurt. But her parental retained his interest in her, even when it must have seemed to him that everyone else laughed at her. He tried, in his clumsy way, to shield her from the others. He followed her to the surface sometimes, even though he hated it himself, in order to make sure she was safe. She came upon him once, talking to a hard one. It was hard for a parental to talk to a hard one. Even though she was quite young, she knew that much. Hard ones talked only to rationals. She was quite frightened, and she whisked away, but not before she had heard her parental say, "I take good care of her, hard sir." Could the hard one have inquired about her? About her queerness, perhaps. But her parental had not been apologetic. Even to the hard one, he had spoken of his concern for her. Dua felt an obscure pride. But now he was leaving, and suddenly all the independence that Dua had been looking forward to lost its fine shape and hardened into the pointed crag of loneliness. She said, "But why must you pass on?"
"I must, little Midgear."
"You must." She knew that. Everyone, sooner or later, must. The day would come when she would have to sigh and say, "I must." "But what makes you know when you have to pass on? If you can choose your time, why don't you choose a different time and stay longer?" He said, "Your left father has decided. The triad must do as he says." "Why must you do what he says?" She hardly ever saw her left father or her mid-mother. They didn't count anymore. Only her right father, her parental, her daddy, who stood there squat and flat-surfaced. He wasn't all smooth-curved like a rational, or shuddery uneven like an emotional, and she could always tell what he was going to say. Almost always. She was sure he would say, "I can't explain to a little emotional." He said it. Dua said in a burst of woe, "I'll miss you. I know you think I pay you no attention, and I don't like you for always telling me not to do things, but I would rather not like you for telling me not to do things than not have you around to tell me not to do things." And Daddy just stood there. There was no way he could handle an outburst like that, except to come closer and pinch out a hand. It cost him a visible effort, but he held it out, trembling, and its outlines were ever so slightly soft. Dua said, "Oh, Daddy," and let her own hand flow about it, so that his looked misty and shimmery through her substance. But she was careful not to touch it, for that would have embarrassed him so. Then he withdrew it, and left her hand enclosing nothing, and he said, "Remember the hard ones, Dua. They will help you. I will go now." He went, and she never saw him again. Now she sat there, remembering in the sunset, and rebelliously aware that pretty soon Trit would grow petulant over her absence and nag Odine, and then Odine might lecture her on her duties. She didn't care. 1B. Odine was moderately aware that Dua was off on the surface. Without really thinking about it, he could judge her direction and even something of her distance. If he had stopped to think of it, he might have felt displeasure, for this inter-awareness sense had been steadily deadening for a long time now, and, without really being certain why, he had a sense of gathering fulfillment about it. It was the way things were supposed to be, the sign of the continuing development of the body with age. Trit's inter-awareness sense did not decrease, but it shifted more and more toward the children. That was clearly the line of useful development, but then the role of the parental was a simple one, in a manner of speaking, however important. The rational was far more complex, and Odin took a bleak satisfaction in that thought. Of course it was Dua who was the real puzzle. She was so unlike all the other emotionals. That puzzled and frustrated Trit, and reduced him to even more pronounced inarticulacy. It puzzled and frustrated Odin at times, too, but he was also aware of Dua's infinite capacity to induce satisfaction with life, and it did not seem likely that one was independent of the other. The occasional exasperation she produced was a small price to pay for the intense happiness. And maybe Dua's odd way of life was part of what ought to be, too. The hard ones seemed interested in her, and ordinarily they paid attention only to rationals. He felt pride in that. So much the better for the triad that even the emotional was worth attention. Things were as they were supposed to be. That was bedrock, and it was what he wanted most to feel right down to the end. Someday he would even know when it was time to pass on, and then he would want to. The hard ones assured him of that, as they assured all rationals, but they also told him that it was his own inner consciousness that would mark the time unmistakably, and not any advice from outside. "When you tell yourself," Losten had told him, in the clear, careful way in which a hard one always talked to a soft one, as though the hard one were laboring to make himself understood, "that you know why you must pass on, then you will pass on, and your triad will pass on with you." And Odin had said, "I cannot say I wish to pass on now, hard sir. There is so much to learn." "Of course, left dear, you feel this because you are not yet ready." Odin thought, "How could I ever feel ready when I would never feel there wasn't much to learn?" But he didn't say so. He was quite certain the time would come, and he would then understand. He looked down at himself, almost forgetting and thrusting out an eye to do so. There were always some childish impulses in even the most adult of the most rational. He didn't have to, of course. He could sense quite well with his eyes solidly in place, and he found himself satisfactorily solid, nice, sharp outline, smooth and curved into gracefully conjoined ovoids. His body lacked the strangely attractive shimmer of Dua and the comforting stockiness of Krit. He loved them both, but he would not change his own body for either, and, of course, his own mind. He would never say so, of course, for he would not want to hurt their feelings, but he never ceased being thankful that he did not have Trit's limited understanding, or, even more, Dua's erratic one. He supposed they didn't mind, for they knew nothing else. He grew distantly aware of Dua again, and deliberately dulled the sense. At the moment, he felt no need for her. It was not that he wanted her less, but merely that he had increasing drives elsewhere. It was part of the growing maturity of a rational to find more and more satisfaction in the exercise of a mind that could only be practiced alone, and with the hard ones. He grew constantly more accustomed to the hard ones, constantly more attached to them. He felt that was right and proper, too, for he was a rational, and in a way, the hard ones were super-rationals. He had once said that to Losten, the friendliest of the hard ones, and, it seemed to Odin in some vague way, the youngest. Losten had radiated amusement, but had said nothing, and that meant he had not denied it, however. Odin's earliest memories were filled with hard ones. His parental more and more concentrated his attention on the last child, the baby emotional. That was only natural. Trit would do it, too, when the last child came, if it ever did. Odin had picked up that last qualification from Trit, who used it constantly as a reproach to Dua. But so much the better. With his parental busy so much at the time, Odin could begin his education that much the earlier. He was losing his baby ways, and he had learned a great deal even before he met Trit. That meeting, though, was surely something he would never forget. It might as well have been yesterday as more than half a lifetime ago. He had seen parentals of his own generation, of course, young ones who, long before they incubated the children that made true parentals of them, showed few signs of the stolidity to come. As a child, he had played with his own right brother, and was scarcely aware of any intellectual difference between them, though, looking back on those days, he recognized that it was there, even then. He knew also, vaguely, the role of a parental in a triad. Even as a child, he had heard whispered tales of melting. When Trit first appeared, when Odin saw him first, everything changed. For the first time in his life, Odin felt an inner warmth and began to think that there was something he wanted that was utterly divorced from thought. Even now, he could remember the sense of embarrassment that had accompanied this. Trit was not embarrassed, of course. Parentals were never embarrassed about the activities of the triad, and emotionals were almost never embarrassed. Only rationals had that problem. "Too much thinking," a hard one had said when Odin had discussed the problem with him, and that left Odin dissatisfied. In what way could thinking be too much? Trit was young when they first met, of course. He was still so childish as to be uncertain in his blockishness, so that his reaction to the meeting was embarrassingly clear. He grew almost translucent along his edges. Odin said hesitantly, "I haven't seen you before, have I, right fellow?" Trip said, "I have never been here. I have been brought here." They both knew exactly what had happened to them. The meeting had been arranged because someone, some parental, Odin had thought at the time, but later he knew it was some hard one, thought they would suit each other, and the thought was correct. There was no intellectual rapport between the two, of course. How could there be, when Odin wanted to learn with an intensity that superseded anything but the existence of the triad itself, and Trit lacked the very concept of learning? What Trit had to know, he knew beyond either learning or unlearning. Odin, out of the excitement of finding out about the world and its sun, about the history and mechanism of life, about all the abouts in the universe, sometimes, in those early days together, found himself spilling over to Trit. Trit listened placidly, clearly understanding nothing, but content to be listening, while Odin, transmitting nothing, was as clearly content to be lecturing. It was Trit who made the first move, driven by his special needs. Odin was chattering about what he had learned that day after the brief midday meal. Their thicker substance absorbed food so rapidly, they were satisfied with a simple walk in the sun, while emotionals basked for hours at a time, curdling and thinning, as though deliberately to lengthen the task. Odin, who always ignored the emotionals, was quite happy to be talking. Trit, who stared wordlessly at them day after day, was now visibly restless. Abruptly, he came close to Odin, formed an appendage so hastily as to clash most disagreeably on the other's form sense. He placed it upon a portion of Odin's upper ovoid, where a slight shimmer was allowing a welcome draft of warm air as dessert. Trit's appendage thinned with a visible effort, and sank into the superficies of Odin's skin before the latter darted away, horribly embarrassed. Odin had done such things as a baby, of course, but never since his adolescence. "Don't do that, Trit," he said sharply. Trit's appendage remained out, groping a little. "I want to." Odin held himself as compactly as he could, striving to harden the surface to bar entry. "I don't want to." "Why not?" said Trit urgently. "There's nothing wrong." Odin said the first thing that came into his mind. "It hurt." It didn't really, not physically. But the hard ones always avoided the touch of the soft ones. A careless interpenetration hurt them. But they were constructed differently from soft ones, completely differently. Trit was not fooled by that. His instinct could not possibly mislead him in this respect. He said, "It didn't hurt." "Well, it isn't right this way. We need an emotional." And Trit could only say, stubbornly, "I want to anyway." It was bound to continue happening, and Odin was bound to give in. He always did. It was something that was sure to happen, even to the most self-conscious rational. As the old saying had it, everyone either admitted doing it or lied about it. Trit was with him at each meeting after that. If not with an appendage, then rim to rim. And finally Odin, seduced by the pleasure of it, began to help and tried to shine. He was better at that than Trit was. Poor Trit, infinitely more eager, huffed and strained, and could achieve only the barest shimmer here and there, patchily and raggedly. Odin, however, could turn translucent all over his surface, and fought down his embarrassment in order to let himself flow against Trit. There was skin-deep penetration, and Odin could feel the pulsing of Trit's hard surface under the skin. There was enjoyment, riddled with guilt. Trit, as often as not, was tired and vaguely angry when it was all over. Odin said, "Now, Trit, I've told you we need an emotional to do this properly. You can't be angry at something that just is." And Trit said, "Let's get an emotional." Let's get an emotional. Trit's simple drives never led him to anything but direct action. Odin was not sure he could explain the complexities of life to the other. "It's not that easy, Reitling," he began gently. Trit said abruptly, "The hard ones can do it. You're friendly with them. Ask them." Odin was horrified. "I can't ask." "The time," he continued, unconsciously falling into his lecturing voice, "is not yet come, or I would certainly know it. Until such time..." Trit was not listening. He said, "I'll ask." "No," said Odin, horrified. "You stay out of it. I tell you, it's not time. I have an education to worry about. It's very easy to be a parental and not have to know anything, but..." He was sorry the instant he had said it, and it was a lie anyway. He just didn't want to do anything at all that might offend the hard ones and impede his useful relationship with them. Trit, however, showed no signs of minding, and it occurred to Odin that the other saw no point or merit in knowing anything he did not already know, and would not consider the statement of the fact an insult. The problem of the emotional kept coming up, though. Occasionally, they tried interpenetration. In fact, the impulse grew stronger with time. It was never truly satisfying, though it had its pleasure, and each time Trit would demand an emotional. Each time, Odin threw himself deeper into his studies, almost as a defense against the problem. Yet, at times, he was almost tempted to speak to Losten about it. Losten was the hard one he knew best, the one who took the greatest personal interest in him. There was a deadly sameness about the hard ones, because they did not change. They never changed. Their form was fixed. Where their eyes were, and always in the same place for all of them. Their skin was not exactly hard, but it was always opaque, never shimmered, never vague, never penetrable by another skin of its own type. They were not larger in size particularly than the soft ones, but they were heavier. Their substance was much denser, and they had to be careful about the yielding tissues of the soft ones. Once, when he had been little, really little, and his body had flowed almost as freely as its sister's, he had been approached by a hard one. He had never known which one it was, but he learned in later life that they were all of them curious about baby rationals. Odin had reached up for the hard one out of nothing but curiosity. The hard one had sprung backward, and later Odin's parental had scolded him for offering to touch a hard one. The scolding had been harsh enough for Odin never to forget. When he was older, he learned that the close-packed atoms of the hard one's tissues felt pain on the forcible penetration of others. Odin wondered if the soft one felt pain, too. Another young rational once told him that he had stumbled against a hard one, and the hard one had doubled up, but that he himself had felt nothing. But Odin wasn't sure this was not just a melodramatic boast. There were other things he could not do. He liked rubbing against the walls of the cavern. There was a pleasant, warm feeling when he allowed himself to penetrate rock. Babies always did it, but it got harder to do as he grew older. Still, he could do it skin deep, and he liked it. But his parental found him doing it and scolded him. He objected that his sister did it all the time. He had seen her. "That's different," said the parental. "She's an emotional." At another time, when Odin was absorbing a recording, he was older then, he had idly formed a couple of projections and made the tips so thin he could pass one through the other. He began to do it regularly when he listened. There was a pleasant tickling sensation that made it easier to listen and made him nicely sleepy afterward. And his parental caught him at that, too, and what he had said still made Odin uncomfortable in remembering it. No one really told him about melting in those days. They fed him knowledge and educated him about everything except what the triad was all about. Trit had never been told either, but he was a parental, so he knew without being told. Of course, when Dua came at last, all was clear, even though she seemed to know less about it even than Odin. But she didn't come to them because of anything Odin did. It was Trit who broached the matter. Trit, who ordinarily feared the hard ones and avoided them mutely. Trit, who lacked Odin's self-assurance in all but this respect. Trit, who on this one subject was driven. Trit, Trit, Trit. Odin sighed. Trit was invading his thoughts, because Trit was coming. He could feel him, harsh, demanding, always demanding. Odin had so little time to himself these days, just when he felt that he needed to think more than ever to straighten out all the thoughts. Yes, Trip, he said. 1C. Trit was conscious of his blockiness. He didn't think it ugly. He didn't think about it at all. If he did, he would consider it beautiful. His body was designed for a purpose and designed well. He said, Odin, where is Dua? Outside somewhere, mumbled Odin, almost as though he didn't care. It annoyed Trit to have the triad made so little of. Dua was so difficult, and Odin didn't care. Why do you let her go? How can I stop her, Trit? And what harm does it do? You know the harm. We have 2 babies. We need a 3rd. It is so hard to make a little mid these days. Dua must be well fed for it to be made. Now she is wandering about at sunset again. How can she feed properly at sunset? She's just not a great feeder. And we just don't have a little mid, Odin. Trit's voice was caressing. How can I love you properly without Dua? Now then, mumbled Odin, and Trit felt himself once more puzzled by the other's clear embarrassment at the simplest statement of fact. Trit said, Remember, I was the one who first got Dua. Did Odin remember that? Did Odin ever think of the triad and what it meant? Sometimes Trit felt so frustrated he could... Actually, he didn't know what to do, but he knew he felt frustrated. As in those old days when he wanted an emotional and Odin would do nothing. Trit knew he didn't have the trick of talking in big, elaborate sentences. But if Paredes didn't talk, they thought... They thought about important things. Odin always talked about atoms and energy. Who cared about atoms and energy? Trit thought about the triad and the babies. Odin had once told him that the numbers of soft ones were gradually growing fewer. Didn't he care? Didn't the hard ones care? Did anyone care but the parentals? Only 2 forms of life on all the world, the soft ones and the hard ones, and food shining down on them. Odin had once told him the sun was cooling off. There was less food, he said, so there were less people. Trit didn't believe it. The sun felt no cooler than it had when he was a baby. It was just that people weren't worrying about the triads anymore. Too many absorbed rationals, too many silly emotionals. What the soft ones must do was concentrate on the important things of life. Trit did. He tended to the business of the triad. The baby left came, then the baby right. They were growing and flourishing. They had to have a baby mid, though. That was the hardest to get started, and without a baby mid, there would be no new triad. What made Dua as she was? She had always been difficult, but she was growing worse. Trip felt an obscure anger against Odin. Odin always talked with all those hard words, and Dua listened. Odin would talk to Dua endlessly, so they were almost 2 rationals. That was bad for the triad. Odin should know better. It was always Trit who had to care. It was always Trit who had to do what had to be done. Odin was the friend of the hard ones, and yet he said nothing. They needed an emotional, and yet Odin would say nothing. Odin talked to them of energy, and not of the needs of the triad. It had been Trit who had turned the scale. Trit remembered that proudly. He had seen Odin talking to a hard one, and he had approached. Without a shake in his voice, he had interrupted and said, We need an emotional. The hard one turned to look at him. Trit had never been so close to a hard one. He was all of a piece. Every part of him had to turn when one part did. He had some projections that could move by themselves, but they never changed in shape. They never flowed and were irregular and unlovely. They didn't like to be touched. The hard one said, "Is this so, Odin?" He did not talk to Trip. Odin flattened. He flattened close to the ground, more flattened than Trit had ever seen. He said, "My rightling is overzealous. My rightling is... He stuttered and puffed and could not speak. Trit could speak. He said, "We cannot melt without one." Trit knew that Odin was embarrassed into speechlessness, but he didn't care. It was time. "Well, Left dear," said the Hard One to Odin, "do you feel the same way about it?" Hard One spoke as the Soft Ones did, but more harshly and with fewer overtones. They were hard to listen to. Trit found them hard anyway, though Odin seemed used to it. "Yes," said Odin finally. The Hard One turned at last to Trit. "Remind me, young Wright, how long have you and Odin been together?" "Long enough," said Trit, "to deserve an emotional..." He kept his shape firmly at angles. He did not allow himself to be frightened. This was too important. He said, "And my name is Trit." The Hard One seemed amused. "Yes, the choice was good. You and Odin go well together. But it makes the choice of an emotional difficult. We have almost made up our minds. Or at least, I have long since made up my mind. But the others must be convinced. Be patient, Trit." "I am tired of patience." "I know, but be patient anyway." He was amused again. When he was quite gone, Odin uplifted himself and thinned out angrily. He said, "How could you do that, Trit? Do you know who he was?" "He was a Hard One." "He was Losten. He is my special teacher. I don't want him angry with me." "Why should he be angry? I was polite." "Well, never mind." Odin was settling into normal shape. That meant he wasn't angry anymore. That relieved Trit, though he tried not to show it. "It's very embarrassing to have my dumb Wright come up and speak out to my Hard One." "Why didn't you do it then?" "There's such a thing as the right time." "But never's the right time to you." But then they rubbed surfaces and stopped arguing, and it wasn't long after that that Dua came. It was Losten that brought her. Trip didn't know that. He didn't look at the Hard One, only at Dua. But Odin told him afterward that it was Losten that brought her. "You see," said Trit, "it was I who talked to him. That is why he brought her." "No," said Odin, "it was time. He would have brought her even if neither of us had talked to him." Trit didn't believe him. He was quite sure that it was entirely because of himself that Dua was with him. Surely there was never anyone like Dua in the world. Trit had seen many emotionals. They were all attractive. He would have accepted any one of them for proper melting. Once he saw Dua, he realized that none of the others would have suited. Only Dua. Only Dua. And Dua knew exactly what to do. Exactly. No one had ever shown her how, she told them afterward. No one had ever talked to her about it. Even other emotionals hadn't, for she avoided them. Yet when all three were together, each knew what to do. Dua thinned. She thinned more than Trit had ever seen a person thin. She thinned more than Trit would ever have thought possible. She became a kind of colored smoke that filled the room and dazzled him. He moved without knowing he was moving. He immersed himself in the air that was Dua. There was no sensation of penetration, none at all. Trit felt no resistance, no friction. There was just a floating inward and a rapid palpitation. He felt himself beginning to thin in sympathy, and without the tremendous effort that had always accompanied it. With Dua filling him, he could thin without effort into a thick smoke of his own. Thinning became like flowing, one enormous, smooth flow. Dimly, he could see Odin approaching from the other side, from Dua's left, and he too was thinning. Then, like all the shocks of contact in all the world, he reached Odin. But it wasn't a shock at all. Trip felt without feeling, knew without knowing. He slid into Odin, and Odin slid into him. He couldn't tell whether he was surrounding Odin, or being surrounded by him, or both, or neither. It was only pleasure. The senses dimmed with the intensity of that pleasure, and at the point where he thought he could stand no more, the senses failed altogether. Eventually, they separated and stared at each other. They had melted for days. Of course, melting always took time. The better it was, the longer it took, but when it was over, all that time seemed as though it had been an instant, and they did not remember it. In later life, it rarely took longer than that first time. Odin said, "That was wonderful." Trit only gazed at Dua, who had made it possible. She was coalescing, swirling, moving tremulously. She seemed most affected of the three. "We'll do it again," she said hurriedly, "but later, later. Let me go now." She had run off. They did not stop her. They were too overcome to stop her. But that was always the way afterward. She was always gone after a melting. No matter how successful it was, she would go. There seemed something in her that needed to be alone. It bothered Trip. In point after point, she was different from other emotionals. She shouldn't be. Odin felt differently. He would say on many occasions, "Why don't you leave her alone, Trit? She's not like the others, and that means she's better than the others. Melting wouldn't be as good if she were like the others. Do you want the benefits without paying the price?" Trit did not understand that clearly. He knew only that she ought to do what ought to be done. He said, "I want her to do what is right." "I know, Trit, I know, but leave her alone anyway." Odin often scolded Dua himself for her queer ways, but was always unwilling to let Trit do so. "You lack tact, Trit," he would say. Trit didn't know what tact was exactly. And now, it had been so long since the first melting, and still the baby emotional was not born. How much longer? It was already much too long. And Dua, if anything, stayed by herself more and more as time went on. Trit said, "She doesn't eat enough." "When it's time," began Odin. "You always talk about it being time or it's not being time. You never found it time to get Dua in the first place. Now you never find it time to have a baby emotional. Dua should..." But Odin turned away. He said, "She's out there, Trit. If you want to go out and get her as though you were her parental instead of her rightling, do so. But I say, leave her alone." Trit backed away. He had a great deal to say, but he didn't know how to say it. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.